Thank you, Kevin, and thank you, Ted. Did you have a number you wanted to sing at the end, or you'll pick it later?
All right.
It's good to see all of you here back with us again this evening in our study of the book of Revelation. We're continuing with the first seal in Revelation chapter 6, verse 2. We have seen that the Old Testament gave us information about the Babylonian Empire, the Medo-Persian Empire, and even a considerable amount about the Macedonian or Grecian Empire. It was left to the New Testament book of prophecy to tell us about the fourth great world empire, the Roman Empire. And we've been looking at this first seal, getting into the unfolding of that history. I have told you that I believe this first seal is talking about what historians call the age of the Antonines. Nerva, Trajan, Hadrian, Antoninus Pius, Marcus Aurelius. These were the five good emperors, and they are often referred to as living in the age of the Antonines, a period of great victory and prosperity in the Roman Empire when they went forth conquering and to conquer. And last night I was beginning to read to you a bit from the work of Edward Gibbon. I introduced him to you. I read one little sentence when I happened to notice that our time was farther evaporated than I thought. Let me start with that paragraph and read just a little bit further than I did last night. I think I only got one sentence out. Here's what Edward Gibbon had to say about this period of history that we've introduced, beginning in 96 A.D. If a man were called to fix the period in the history of the world during which the condition of the human race was most happy and prosperous, he would, without hesitation, name that which elapsed from the death of Domitian to the accession of Commodus. The vast extent of the Roman Empire was governed by absolute power under the guidance of virtue and wisdom. The armies were restrained by the firm but gentle hand of four successive emperors whose characters and authority commanded involuntary respect. The forms of the civil administration were carefully preserved by Nerva, Trajan, Hadrian, and the Antonines, who delighted in the image of liberty and were pleased with considering themselves as the accountable ministers of the laws. This is the period of time that seems to be discussed in the first seal. Trajan went forth conquering and to conquer. Let me read you just one more section, if you don't mind going back. This is the Modern Library edition of Edward Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, and I'm reading from Volume 1. That was page 70 that I just read, and this is from page 6 of Volume 1, speaking of Trajan in particular. Trajan was ambitious of fame. And as long as mankind shall continue to bestow more liberal applause on their destroyers than on their benefactors, the thirst of military glory will ever be the vice of the most exalted characters. The praises of Alexander, transmitted by a succession of poets and historians, had kindled a dangerous emulation in the mind of Trajan. Like him, the Roman emperor undertook an expedition against the nations of the East, but he lamented with a sigh that his advanced age scarcely left him any hopes of equaling the renown of the son of Philip. The son of Philip was Alexander the Great. Yet the success of Trajan, however transient, was rapid and specious. Then he goes on and talks about some of the things that Trajan did in his wars. He enjoyed the honor of being the first, as he was the last of the Roman generals, who ever navigated upon the Persian Gulf. His fleets ravaged the coast of Arabia, and Trajan vainly flattered himself that he was approaching even toward the confines of India. Every day, the astonished Roman Senate received the intelligence of new names and new nations that acknowledged his sway. They were informed that the kings of the Bosphorus, Caucasus, Iberia, Albania, and then he goes on and mentions some more places, all accepted their diadems from the hands of the emperor. So this is Trajan. He went forth conquering and to conquer. It was an era of a white horse in the sense of a victorious series of wars by the Roman Empire that increased the Roman Empire to the extent that we see it on the maps as it was in 117 AD at the end of Trajan's reign. He went forth conquering and to conquer, just as it says here at the end of verse 2, and brought the Roman Empire to achievement of its fullest geographical extent. So the first seal is about this period of the greatest victory and prosperity that was ever known in the Roman Empire. Now, we're not going to spend probably as much time on each seal as we did on that first one, setting up the explanation of it, but I think it's especially important to try to be sure that we get the first one right and to understand why and how we are getting it right. Because if we start in the wrong place, then we've gotten a building block wrong, and it may affect our ability to understand what follows. Are there any questions, comments? Yes, Ted. Okay, the first seal starting with 96 AD because the time is at hand. These are things that must shortly come to pass. And if we take the position that this is what he's referring to, then that fits in so beautifully with the time. I think the idea of the Roman Empire here is just almost implicit in the book itself, the symbols that are used. We've already had explanation of the other three empires, and yet very little was said about the Roman Empire. And this was such an important part. And as we go through these seals, I think it becomes more and more apparent that this must be what is being referred to. It's such a wonderful explanation of the details of the book of Revelation that I personally feel that there's no possibility of error. But then I'm prejudiced toward my own point of view, of course. So you have to take that with a grain of salt. But I feel much more strongly about this point of view than I did back 40 years ago when I began teaching this. It just seems that the more you look at it, what else can this possibly be? That's an excellent question. Did you have further comment on that? Okay. Yes, Dwayne.
This age of the Antonines,
yes,
victory and prosperity, I don't think you're intending to say that there was no martyrdom of Christians during
that. Oh, no. No, when we get to the fifth seal, we'll cover that in detail. Okay. All the time during this, there was one wave after another of persecution, 10 general waves of persecution.
So the end of Trajan's reign, is that kind of, can you pinpoint the dates between the seals?
Yeah, this seal I've dated from 96, when Trajan comes to the throne, to 183, 3 years into the reign of Commodus when he went a little berserk. And then after Commodus is assassinated in 192, things really fall apart. Yes,
so
Tom.
We will talk about these martyrs.
Yes, so
in other seals.
Under the fifth seal, yes.
But it's back in this time.
Yes, we'll go back even to Nero to talk about the martyrs. Nero will be the first one, and then Domitian the second one. Domitian right at this time. Excellent question. Yes, Tom.
In regard to Chad's question, the details of history fit perfectly in this same line of order as these events are revealed by John.
Right. Absolutely true. There's just nothing else that it can be historically that I would know of at all. The Roman Empire was the earth. I mean, it was equated that way. Oikumenike, that expression referred to the empire and is translated as earth.
It's almost as if history was written before it took place.
Yes, that's exactly what happened. With God, who sees the end from the beginning and calls the things which be not as though they were, is able to write history whether it's already happened or not. That's exactly what happened. Thank you, everybody. Anybody else or any of those of who have already commented got anything else to say before we go on to the second seal? Well, I appreciate you trying to nail these things down. That's what we need, and feel free to always go back if we get lost or if we need to look back at something we have previously covered. The second seal, verses 3 and 4. When he had opened the second seal, I heard the second living creature say, "Come and see." And there went out another horse that was red, and power was given to him that sat thereon to take peace from the earth, and that they should kill one another. And there was given unto him a great sword. Once again, we have a horse, which is a symbol of warfare. This time the horse is red, which is the symbol of blood. So we have especially bloody warfare that's being referred to. It was given to him that sat thereon to take peace from the earth, I believe referring to the Roman Empire, that they should kill one another. An interesting phrase where this warfare is concerned. As a nation, we in the United States have fought many, many wars through the years. But we've only fought one war where we killed one another. Which war was that? The Civil War. And our Civil War, as you well know, lasted from 1861 to 1865, 4 years, and that was plenty long enough. It was a terrible time in the history of our country. But the Civil War in the Roman Empire lasted almost a century. And I'll go ahead and place this up here and tell you why I believe that that's what we're talking about. An era of civil warfare, and I'm going to date this. Some of these dates are a bit arbitrary because we get into things gradually and you could date them a little differently. But I'm going to date this from about 192 to 284 with the accession of Diocletian. And I'll try to tell you more about the dating of that as we go along. But I think if we ended in 284 with the accession of Diocletian, that is a pretty legitimate dividing line there. Early in the reign of Commodus, who was the son of Marcus Aurelius, last night we talked about the principle of heredity being set aside for almost a century here, and these men that did not have sons that could reign were able to adopt the fittest and the ablest emperor and make him their son by law, and then he could take over rather than letting their genetic offspring, whatever they were like, to take over. So, but at the time of Marcus Aurelius, his son Commodus did take over, and that's where the age of the Antonines ends. Commodus was not a good emperor at all, and he got worse as he went along. Early in his reign, there was an assassination attempt against his life, but the assassin was not very crafty in the way he went about it. Commodus was over there where those flowers are, and it's like the assassin was over here, and he starts out with his dagger way far away. Commodus, the Senate sends you this. And he starts toward him, and of course the Praetorian guards, the bodyguards of the emperor, they're all around. They dispatch the would-be assassin right away. They get rid of him. Commodus is untouched, but yet Commodus was changed by this experience. He had a tendency to paranoia anyway, and he became more and more paranoid after that time, and became worse and worse until they couldn't stand him anymore, and he was finally assassinated for real on the last day of the year 192 AD. And this ushered in an era of civil warfare and strife that was just absolutely incredible. I don't believe there has ever been another civil war like this one. The book is exactly right here. Peace was taken from the earth for nearly 100 years. As a matter of fact, Sismondi in his book, The Fall of the Roman Empire, says, "With Commodus commenced the third and most calamitous period. It lasted 92 years, from 192 to 284. During that period, 32 emperors and 27 pretenders alternately hurled each other from the throne in incessant civil warfare." 92 years of almost incessant civil warfare taught the world on what a frail foundation the virtue of the Antonines had placed the felicity of the empire. So that's what Sismondi has to say. Now, when Edward Gibbon, whom we've already introduced to you, covers this same period of time, he tells about 34 emperors and 19 pretenders, or tyrants, pretenders to the throne during this period. It was such a period of chaotic upheaval that the historical records of that time are somewhat jumbled, and we can't even tell exactly how many rulers there were or who to count as a ruler and who not to. Of these 34 emperors and 19 pretenders that Gibbon talks about, all but two of them died violent deaths as they just hurled one another from the throne and took over to reign for a little while before they themselves were taken away. The part about the great stone, the great sword, the last two words of verse 4, I think is referring to the military. They had a standing army that were known as men of the sword, and in this period they were having a great many quarrels among themselves. Now, as we've said, we had a civil war. It lasted for 4 years, and it was fought over principles. It was fought over states' rights. It was fought over slavery and related issues of this sort, economic issues and so forth. The Civil War in England was fought over the rights of kings. But the civil war in the Roman Empire that we're talking about tonight was fought over the ambitions of military men. It wasn't over any principle of truth or right. It was just over everybody wants to reign. The winds are always howling around the highest peaks. So it was the era of the sword. The Praetorian Guard, who were the bodyguards of the emperors, had a prefect, and that prefect was given a sword as symbolic of his right. He could legally kill in the city of Rome itself. In 193, the emperor Pertinax was assassinated by his own bodyguards, by the Praetorian Guard, and after that, lots and lots of other emperors as well were assassinated by the Praetorian Guard. So I think that's probably what is indicated there by the great sword at the end of verse 4. Now, God, through Ezekiel, back in the book of Ezekiel, spoke about four sore judgments, the four sore judgments of God. And as we get ready to look at seals 3 and 4, and as I've said, these are a unit. We need to really consider the four of them together as a unit, and then we'll go on to 5, 6, and 7. But as we get ready to consider the third and the fourth seal, I'd like to read to you just a couple passages from back in the book of Ezekiel. I ordinarily haven't been taking time to go back to the Old Testament too much because I think the group that gathers for these studies is fairly familiar with it. But I want to read to you just a couple of verses here from Ezekiel. First in Ezekiel 5, verses 16 and 17, talking about these four sore judgments. "When I shall send upon them the evil arrows of famine, which shall be for their destruction, and which I will send to destroy you, I will increase the famine upon you and will break your staff of bread. So will I send upon you famine and evil beast, and they shall bereave thee, and pestilence and blood shall pass through thee, and I will bring the sword upon thee. I, the Lord, have spoken it." Now I'd like to pass from that quickly on over to the 14th chapter of the book of Ezekiel, Ezekiel chapter 14, verse 21. "For thus saith the Lord God, how much more when I send my four sore judgments upon Jerusalem, the sword and the famine and the noisome beast and the pestilence, to cut off from it man and beast." Ezekiel explicitly mentions these four sore judgments, and he talks about them as if they are a natural cycle. And I think this is exactly right. They produce a natural cycle because one tends by nature to follow another. First of all, the sword. When your back is against the wall militarily, when there is a war being fought on in your own land, and all of your able men are taken from their jobs to be soldiers, then there's nobody left to farm the land. And when there's nobody left to farm the land, then the price of food goes up because you don't have the food that you used to have. When my grandfather, for example, and this wasn't even a war that was fought on our land, it was fought over in Europe, but my grandpa went down as a young man to sign up to go fight in World War I. And they told him at the time that he tried to register for this, "You've already got two older brothers fighting in France right now. We need you to stay in Missouri and farm the land," because that was an important part of the project as well. But when all the farmers become soldiers, if that war had been fought on our land and our back was to the wall militarily, then all of our farmers would have become soldiers, and then there's nobody left to raise food. And also when opposing armies are marching back and forth constantly across the farmland and they're burning and pillaging, everybody remembers in the Civil War, Sherman's march to the sea and the burning of Atlanta and all of that, a terrible, terrible time. This creates a famine and inflation in the price of food. Too much money chasing too few goods. And then when people don't have enough to eat, they become susceptible to pestilence. Pestilence which is brought on by malnutrition that makes them more susceptible to disease. During the flu epidemic of 1917 and 1918 in this country, the bodies literally stacked up in the mortuaries unburied because there weren't enough men that were strong enough to dig graves for them. Everybody was sick or just was getting over being sick. Graves, of course, were dug by hands in those days. So they were weakened by famine. And then when people are weakened by famine and polluted by the decaying bodies of those who have already died and remain unburied, people become easy prey to plague and all varieties of incurable diseases. And then the wild animals begin to burgeon. as the underbrush grows up on the farms because there's nobody to take care of the land, there are lots of bodies lying around, and the wild animals feed on these and breed and thrive. These are the four sore judgments of God. This is one of the ways that God punishes nations. And I think we see these four sore judgments among these four seals that we're seeing open right now. Anybody have any questions, comments, or thoughts on the second seal?
So that was literal.
Yes.
What happened?
Yes, that was a literal civil war.
Okay,
a literal civil war. And the red horse is a symbol of that literal fulfillment.
Sword, famine, pestilence, and beast, that was literal.
Yes.
These
things actually happened.
The symbols back in
That was, and I think what is spoken of in Ezekiel, we're going to see here as we play out with the third and fourth seals. Let's take the black horse in verses 5 and 6. When he had opened the third seal, I heard the third beast say, "Come and see." And I beheld, and lo, a black horse, and he that sat on him had a pair of balances in his hand. And I heard a voice in the midst of the four living creatures say, "A measure of wheat for a penny, and three measures of barley for a penny, and see thou hurt not the oil and the wine." The black horse, I believe, is the symbol of calamity, sorrow, despondency, and in particular, famine. This is a time that is concurrent with some of what we've previously discussed, but it has a seal unto itself because it was such an important thing. And I think we can date this probably from around 235 to around 285. So you see it's concurrent with the Civil War. But famine was a special feature of its own. We have famine here and we have an inflation as the result of the Civil War. We have a pair of balances mentioned here, and often when you and I, since we have such a great Greek influence as a part of our cultural heritage, when we see balances, we may tend to think of justice. That's a Greek idea of balances, and we have that on some of our national buildings, a blindfolded statue holding the scales of justice. But the Old Testament of balances, in the idea of balances in the Old Testament was a bit different from that. In the Old Testament, balances are about famine. For instance, Leviticus 26 and 26, "You shall eat your bread by weight." In other words, it's the idea of rationing because there wasn't enough food to go around. So we'll weigh you out the amount of food that it's possible for you to have. Now, a penny was a day's wages. So we're talking here about a terrible and a rather rapidly increasing inflation. Oil and wine were regarded as necessities, but here the people can't have them. They're just too expensive. And I could read you things in Gibbon about this, but I think maybe I won't take the time to do that at this point. I know it's really hard to listen to somebody read from a history book, especially one with those long elliptical sentences. But the fourth seal is like unto this, and I think we can go ahead and talk about it. Let me read 7 and 8. "When he had opened the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the fourth living creature say, 'Come and see.' And I looked, and behold, a pale horse, and his name that sat on him was Death, and Hades followed with him. And power was given unto them over the fourth part of the earth, to kill with sword, and with hunger, and with death, and with the beasts of the earth." And we got those four sore judgments listed right there as well. The pale horse is the final one in this bracket of the first four seals. Now, pale is an expression that seems to mean the color greenish-gray, which is the color of death. Greenish-gray, the pallor of a corpse as it begins to turn toward its decay. I'll give you an example of this. I hope it doesn't seem too gruesome to any of you. When Pope Paul VI died in 1978... I happened to be over in Bloomfield, Indiana at the time, conducting a VBS and a meeting for the congregation there. I was staying with Charlie and Phyllis Greaves. Now, I know Tom and Ann have known Charlie and Phyllis Greaves for years. I don't know that there's anybody else here. Maybe some of the rest of you know them. I know they've been here, but it's been a long time. I think when you had the two-week meeting here in 1977, they stopped in at least for the middle weekend. So they have been here and may be familiar to some of you. Anyway, Charlie Greaves is a very interesting man. And earlier in his life, Charlie had been an undertaker for a number of years. So one night after church, Charlie Greaves, we're sitting in his home there on Mechanic Street in Bloomfield, Indiana. We were watching the coverage of the death of the Pope over in Rome, and it was hot summertime, August of 1978. They had the Pope's body lying out on a slab there in one of the cathedrals in Rome, and thousands of people were walking by for days, like 2 or 3 days or longer, to view the body of the Pope as it was just laying out there in that 100-degree heat. And as we watched that on Charlie's color television set, we could clearly see that the Pope's body had actually started to turn green. And from his perspective as a former undertaker, Charlie said, "Oh no, that's the worst that can happen when they turn green." And that's probably why I've never forgotten that evening. Hades is mentioned here. We've discussed Hades before. It's the abode of departed spirits between death and the resurrection. Death mows us down, and Hades gathers us up. And the pale horse is intended to indicate that, the color of death. Now I think I'm needing to read you a little section of Gibbon again. I try to hold these to a minimum, but I want to read you just one section here about this era of time, because he talks about the famine and what happened, and he gives us something here that helps to indicate what may be meant by the fourth part here in verse 8, the fourth part of the earth. The power was given to death over a fourth part of the earth. Gibbon says, this is volume 1, Modern Library Edition, page 244, "But a long and general famine was a calamity of a more serious kind. It was the inevitable consequence of rapine and oppression, which extirpated the produce of the present and the hope of future harvest. Famine is almost always followed by epidemical diseases, the effect of scanty and unwholesome food. Other causes must, however, have contributed to the furious plague, which from the year 250 to the year 265 raged without interruption in every province, every city, and almost every family of the Roman Empire. During some time, 5,000 persons daily died in Rome, and many towns that had escaped the hands of the barbarians were entirely depopulated." And then he goes on to give an example that I wanted to get to. It might be a little hard to listen to this, so I apologize if it is. "We have the knowledge of a very curious circumstance of some use, perhaps, in the melancholy calculation of human calamities. An exact record was kept at Alexandria of all the citizens entitled to receive the distribution of corn. It was found that the ancient number of those comprised between the ages of 40 and 70 had been equal to the whole sum of the claimants from 14 to 80 years of age who remained alive after the reign of Gallienus. Applying this authentic fact to the most correct tables of mortality, it evidently proves that above half the people of Alexandria had perished. And could we venture to extend the analogy to the other provinces, we might suspect that war, pestilence, and famine had consumed in a few years the majority of the human species." Now, when we read in verse 8 here that power was given to death over a fourth part of the earth, it seems like, well, maybe that might be an exaggeration, that 25% of the population died. But Gibbon, the uninspired historian, makes a guess that over half of the people died. So the Bible is really more conservative in what it's telling us here. And of course, John is writing by inspiration when he says a fourth. Gibbon is just guessing. He's taking records that he has from Alexandria, and he's extrapolating that over the rest of the Roman Empire. So undoubtedly, the more conservative number that the Apostle John is given here, the fourth part of the earth, would be the correct one. That a fourth of the population of the Roman Empire died during this 100-year period of time from the sword and famine and wild animals and the plague. It was a terrible, terrible time. The four sword judgments of God, similar to what we have in Zechariah chapter 6, 1 through 8, which we have not taken the time to go and look at. But it's quite a piece of work, these first four symbols. Any questions, comments? Yes, Eric, first.
Well, we've been talking about each of these four seals being broken and the seals kind of corresponding with these historical segments of time that
yes.
seem to line up with that. But in these four seals being broken, there's also the accounts of the four horses, the white, the red, the black, and the pale.
Yes.
And one thing that hadn't really been mentioned yet, it says that there's always somebody sitting on this horse.
Right.
Is the person on the horse a continuation of the horse in the time period itself, or does that designate a particular...
I think the person on the horse indicates that period of time. Now, you could take the position that it would represent a prominent person from that time. Like, it would be possible to say, for instance, that the man on the white horse would be Nerwa because he was the one who ushered in the age of the Antonines. But I don't think, for me at least, that it's necessary to get that specific, that it would be a certain historical individual. Rather, I think it's representative of all the emperors in the age of the Antonines. Yeah. Good question. I thought there was another hand moving over. Yes, Ben.
So here in verse 8, where it talks about a fourth of the earth.
Yes.
If we take the rest of this passage to be symbolic, mm-hmm. wouldn't it make sense then that a fourth is also symbolic, representative of a large number of people?
It could well be. Okay. Yes, it that's perfectly possible. Now, later on, when we get to sections that talk about a third part of the earth, I think that's really going to be true. It'll be talking about a third part of the empire, an approximate third part of the empire. The empire was divided into east, west, and south. And later in chapters 8 and 9, we'll be hearing things about a third part, which would represent geographical areas. Here, I tend to think that he's talking about something that was empire-wide, and he's talking about around a fourth of the population.
Right. Literal here,
right.
We run into problems with
right.
other numbers.
That's true. And I think I'm only basing that on the facts of history as we have them, that it's perfectly reasonable to think that maybe it was right around 25% death rate. But that might just be an approximation. Yeah. Excellent question. I appreciate the thoughts.
There at the end of verse 8,
yes.
It says the beast of the earth. What do you take that to mean? Because it's already described. Killed the sword, hunger, death.
I think he's talking about wild animals.
You think that's literal and that
yes.
ends with the fourth plague?
Yes, I do. Wild animals have been a real factor up until relatively modern times. We can go back to the 18th century and see packs of wolves that were roving in Paris, for example, that were a real detriment to that society. It was hard to deal with them. And people would stay indoors because they didn't want to be attacked by wolves right in the middle of the city of Paris. It's only been relatively recently that we, with our technological advances, we have controlled the animal kingdom so much that it's hard for us in modern times to believe that wild animals could be a real factor. But until relatively recently, they really were. The sluggard says there's a lion in the street. Well, you know, that was the reason he says that is because that could be true. It might be out there to kill me. And we have numerous biblical examples of lions and other wild animals being a real problem. So yes, with what we know about what proceeds from literal warfare, I would say that he's literally talking about wild animals here.
So
good question.
Was
yes.
Isaiah talking about, Ezekiel?
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
Prophesying at the same time.
No, Ezekiel prophesied 700 years before John. But Ezekiel was talking about what was going to happen in Jerusalem. And my point in going back there was that these four sword judgments have happened over and over again in history. Anytime God wants to discipline a people, as he was disciplining his people in Jerusalem 600 years before Christ, and as he's disciplining the Roman Empire here, it's being predicted 100 years after Christ, but this is predicted ahead a couple hundred years into the future. So it's almost 1,000 years after what Ezekiel was predicting. I mean, the fulfillment of this was almost 1,000 years after what Ezekiel was predicting. But it's still the same four sore judgments. And these still transpire today. They're still ravaging in various parts of the world where warfares are ongoing and there's famine, little children hungry, there's pestilential disease. People are attacked by animals that are uncontrolled. This goes on somewhere about all the time. Excellent question. Yes, Matt.
And kind of a follow-up to Eric's. So do you think, now John was in the spirit, but do you think he, with his eyes, physically saw somebody sitting on these horses?
I think he, in the spirit, he saw them. And yes, it was with his spiritual eyes. I don't know how that worked exactly, but I think it was just as real to him as if it was physically happening. It's happening in the Spirit, and since you and I have never been in the Spirit in this same sense, because this is a miraculous thing, we don't know exactly how it was, but he's seeing it as though it's transpiring. Although it's not literally occurring, he's seeing it and he's being told to write it down. Good question. Thank you, Matt. Other questions, comments, or thought? And if you ask a question and I just talk about it a while and don't answer it, feel free to follow up and come back with it, because I do that sometimes. Okay? You guys are doing great. We ready to move on to the fifth seal? Very good. This is the one that Dwayne was asking about. And I'll plan to read here verses 9 through 11. Now, we've already mentioned, but I'll say one more time, that often when we have a group of seven, it's divided into groups of three and four. We've just looked at the group of four. And now for the fifth, sixth, and seventh seals, we're moving away from that group. So these will be different kinds of things. Verse 9. When he had opened the fifth seal, I saw under the altar the souls of them that were slain for the word of God and for the testimony which they held. And they cried with a loud voice, saying, How long, O Lord, holy and true, dost thou not judge and avenge our blood on them that dwell on the earth? And white robes were given unto every one of them, and it was said unto them that they should rest yet a little season, until their fellow servants also and their brethren that should be killed as they were should be fulfilled. This fifth seal,
I believe, is the seal of the martyrs.
The seal of the martyrs. The martyrs, in particular, over the course of the first three centuries of the Christian era. Martyrs who were punished for their fidelity to the Lord that you and I serve. Now, when he sees the altar here, we need to remember that the physical temple and altar in Jerusalem have been gone for 26 years when John is seeing this. So the temple that he's seeing is the heavenly temple, perhaps, and of course it's emblematic of the church. And the altar is the place of sacrifice, and I think that's the reason for the mention of the altar. These are people who have been sacrificed. They have sacrificed themselves for the cause of Christ. They have stood firmly faithful to the Lamb, and they allowed themselves to be put to death rather than recant their faith in Jesus Christ. And notice that John sees souls. He's not seeing their bodies here, because these people are not living in the flesh. They've been killed already. But they do have a consciousness after their death, and they are able to communicate with God. You probably know that the word martyr originally just meant witness. To be a martyr was to be a witness. They were killed because they were martyrs. They weren't martyrs because they were killed originally. But because so many of the Lord's witnesses were killed, the word martyr came to mean one who is put to death for a cause, and it's used almost exclusively that way in our time. A martyr is one today who's killed for the faith, but originally it just meant a witness. So many of God's witnesses were killed that the word martyr came to be identified with the word witness. And the blood of the martyrs became the seed of the kingdom. Every time somebody was put to death for their faith, it's as if 100 more people came to the faith. And that was occurring through a number of years here. Now these martyrs are asking a question to the Lord. Lord, we know that vengeance is yours. You have told us that vengeance is not ours. Vengeance is yours. You've told us that you will repay. And we respect the promise that you've made that you will repay. We believe that. But we'd just like to know when. You've said that you will repay. So they ask, how long? How long, O Lord, will it be until you punish them for killing us? And they were told in verse 11 that they should rest a while longer until their fellow servants were also killed, until some total number was reached. This brings us to the place where we can talk about the 10 great waves of general persecution during the first three centuries of the church. And I'll state these for you. I don't know if you want them. I could put them on the board if you care to have them, but I don't know how important they are to you. I'll just start out by stating them, and if you want me to write them on the board, I will. The first one is in the time of Nero, and we have talked about this before. 64 AD would be a date for this, when the fire burned 5/7 of the city of Rome, and Nero blamed the Christians for the fire. Some have accused Nero of starting it himself. He may have. I don't know how to find out the answer to that. But he began to persecute the Christians, and he would use them as human torches to light up his garden parties at night at his palace in Rome. In 67 AD, Paul had his head cut off 3 miles outside of Rome by an executioner. This persecution of Nero was confined primarily to the city of Rome and its environs. The second great wave of persecution was in the reign of Domitian. We've been talking about Domitian, how he persecuted the Apostle John, but he persecuted many other Christians as well. Domitian came to the throne in 81 and died in 96, as we have seen. The Apostle John was exiled by him. Also, there was a great wave of persecution in Trajan. He's number three. In about 108, he was doing these persecutions. Ignatius was one of the so-called apostolic fathers, and he was killed by Trajan around 110 or so. Marcus Aurelius, about whom we've also spoken, 162 AD, killed some of us during his time. Justin Martyr was put to death during the administration of Marcus Aurelius. Justin Martyr wrote a great deal that is very interesting to read. He was a philosopher in the second century. In the first century, it was said, as you know, in the book of 1 Corinthians, the Apostle Paul said, "You see your calling, brethren, how that not many wise men after the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble are called, but God hath chosen the foolish things of this world to confound the wise, and the weak things of the world to confound the things which are mighty." But in the second century, it was not just those who were poor and ignorant who were in the church, the mainstays in the church, as they were in the first century. In the second century, it became more attractive to philosophers and others of that ilk. And Justin Martyr was one of them. He's called Justin Martyr because he was martyred for his faith during the time of Marcus Aurelius. If Paul had been writing in the second century, he wouldn't have written that he wrote to the Corinthians in the first century, because the makeup of the church was beginning to change. And it wasn't always for the best, but the makeup of the church was beginning to change. Number five is Septimius Severus, 193 to 211. Septimius Severus was also responsible for the killing of a number of us. And I say us because these were people who shared the same faith that we have, and to a great extent practiced the same things that we do. Although, it's fair to point out that even in Paul's day, he said the mystery of iniquity doth already work, the apostasy of the church was already happening, and things were being swayed away from the simplicity of the gospel and from the traditions that the Apostle Paul had told us to hold. So it was changing, but still, I think of these persecutions in this second century, at least, as still being of us. During the reign of Septimius Severus, for example, Perpetua and Felicitas were put to death. Perpetua was the owner of Felicitas, who was her slave, but they were two young women in their early 20s, or if they were even that old. They were married young women, and they were with child. They were put into prison. They had their babies. Perpetua's father was sent into her to try to get her to recant her faith. "Think of me, your aging father. You shouldn't lose your life. You need to stay alive so you can take care of me in my helpless old age." But Perpetua stood fast in the faith and did not let anyone persuade her to recant her faith in the Lord Jesus Christ. There's no human relationship that is not to be sacrificed for the cause of our Lord Jesus Christ. So Perpetua and Felicitas, long story short, these modest young Christian women had their clothing stripped from them. They were paraded out into the street. They were pulled behind horses and humiliated in every conceivable kind of way. They were tormented and eventually put to death. But both of them died knowing that the church would take care of their little babies, because that's the way the church operates. I have never known of a case where somebody died in the church and somebody in the church did not finish raising their children if they could get a hold of them. This is just the way the church functions. This is the love and caring in the relationships of the church. It's one of the sadder stories of these early centuries, the story of Perpetua and Felicitas. But there are so many of these stories. Number six, Maximus, around 235 A.D., number seven, Decius, D-E-C-I-U-S, 249 A.D. Number eight, Valerian, 257 A.D. Cyprian, one of the most famous of the Ante-Nicene fathers, was beheaded by the sword in 258 during the reign of Valerian. Number 9, Aurelian, 274. And finally, number 10, Diocletian, 303. Diocletian, and especially his henchman, Galerius. Galerius was the one who really carried through for 8 years on this persecution that Diocletian had started. Gibbon says that Diocletian declared in a series of edicts his intention of abolishing the Christian name from the earth. He really went after this in a big way. In fact, maybe I should read to you just one or two more little passages from Gibbon. I don't know whether these readings are helpful or not, but I do want you to see that the secular historian is talking about these very things. And the application, I hope, is apparent. Here on page 494, Gibbon, and this is still volume 1 of the Modern Library edition, Gibbon is talking about the time of Diocletian. The resentment or the fears of Diocletian at length transported him beyond the bounds of moderation which he had hitherto preserved, and he declared in a series of cruel edicts his intention of abolishing the Christian name. By the first of these edicts, the governors of the provinces were directed to apprehend all persons of the ecclesiastical order, and the prisons destined for the vilest criminals were soon filled with a multitude of bishops, presbyters, deacons, readers, and exorcists. By a second edict, the magistrates were commanded to employ every method of severity which might reclaim them from their odious superstition. That's what he's calling the Christian faith, their odious superstition, and oblige them to return to the established worships of the gods. In other words, leave Christianity and return to paganism. This rigorous order was extended by a subsequent edict to the whole body of Christians who were exposed to a violent and general persecution. Instead of those salutary restraints which had been required, which had required the direct and solemn testimony of an accuser, it became the duty as well as the interest of the imperial officers to discover, to pursue, and to torment the most obnoxious among the faithful. Heavy penalties were denounced against all those who should presume to save a prescribed sectary from the just indignation of the gods and the emperors. Yet, notwithstanding the severity of this law, the virtuous courage of many of the pagans in concealing their friends or relations affords an honorable proof that the rage of superstition had not extinguished in their minds the sentiments of nature and humanity. This means that the pagans were, the persecution was so severe against the Christians that even a number of the pagans would take the Christians in and hide them rather than let their neighbors and friends among the Christians whom they love, because who's easier to love than a group of Christians? They would take them. I mean, seriously, that's generally true, that Christians are the nicest people in the world to know. So even the pagans felt sorry for what was happening. Yes, Mike?
It's easy to understand why God destroyed Jerusalem, the temple, and all that because of the Jews.
Yes.
Any thoughts about why God allowed the faithful church, those that are faithful, to suffer such horrendous persecution and death and for a long period of time?
The only answer I know to that, and it's not a complete one and maybe not even necessarily good, but we are told that the trying of your faith worketh patience. My personal theory about it is, and I can't prove it, but my personal theory about it is that God only allows the amount of suffering, torment, persecution, whatever it is, that we need to make us better people. And indeed, it does make us better people if we look at it from a God's eye view, with the right perspective. The trying of your faith worketh patience. It's referred to in the New Testament as fire, that you are tried as though by fire, and you come out purer than you were before. You learn from it. And when we look at it from God's point of view, death isn't the worst thing in the world by far. There are far worse things than death if you're a Christian. Some of these early Christians were known as the gamblers because they actually would go out and preach the gospel with a view to being killed because they wanted to get out of here. They couldn't feel at home in this world, and they wanted to be released. And we have a record of elders exhorting the congregation, now don't you all get killed this week because we need to assemble next Lord's Day, you know, that type of thing. Just almost totally different mindset than we in our comfortable time in America than we have. I just hope, and I I venture to believe that if this type of persecution were to come upon us, it would purify us, it would make us better. There would be defectors, no doubt. And it would be interesting who defected and who stood firm. It might surprise us who stood firm. Somebody who seems to be strong now might defect, and somebody who seems to be marginal might really be willing to stand against the wall and be shot. But I believe that we've got this within us. We've got this kind of backbone generally among us, that we would stand firm if push came to shove. The writer of the Hebrew letter said one time to the people he was writing to, "You have not yet resisted unto blood, striving against sin." But he indicated that there was going to come a time when they would. And that time may come for us. I wouldn't be surprised to see it during some of our lifetime, that there would be a severe persecution. Don't forget, the Weimar Republic in Germany guaranteed more personal liberties than the United States government does to its citizens now. And that turned around just overnight, instantaneously, when economic problems came, they looked for a savior, and you know the story of what happened in Germany. Don't think that can't happen here, and don't think it can't happen overnight. The main thing we need to do is prepare ourselves between the ears and in our hearts to stand, and having done all, stand. And if we're prepared in that way, then it doesn't too much matter what happens out there in the world and what they do to us. We're going to die anyway if the world stands. We're going to die anyway. It's only a question of when. Napoleon said one time about his troops, they said, "Oh, you're getting so many men killed with these wars." And he said, "They're going to die anyway. Why should they die in agony of cancer at 70 when they can die in glory on the battlefield at 30? I'm not doing them any disservice," he said. Well, he was looking at it for his own personal ambition. But it is true that we're going to die anyway. How can you die better than as a martyr for the Lord? That would be a very honorable thing. So we need to steel ourselves and think in those terms and know that there is some benefit to us for that, and that God looks at this in a way different than we do. And the main thing is to stand firm and faithful for the Lord. "Be thou faithful unto death, and I will give thee the crown of life." And unto death doesn't just mean until you die sometime of old age. Unto death means unto the point of death. Keep on being faithful even though they're going to kill you. Unto death refers not to the duration of your faith, but to the degree of the intensity of your faith. Be faithful even if they're going to kill you. And if we can handle that, you know, I don't wish for persecution at all. We live in a time of a great plenty, and it gives us a lot of opportunities for the Lord. But if persecution does come, it might be good for us. I can see signs that it might help us to sort out what's important and what's not. Because it's easy when we live in such a plentiful society, such a time of prosperity. Distraction is so easy. I know good people in the church who are far too distracted by the world, as Wordsworth said, "The world is too much with us." And a good healthy dose of persecution, which I'm not wishing for, but if it did come, I think it would clarify some things for a lot of us, and that might not be all bad. Duane.
I think we might hear a lot more last messages.
That's right.
Would be as if the last. But on the point of the martyrs, the early Christian martyrs, I think they contributed to the rapid growth of Christianity.
They certainly did. Yes, and as was said back then, the blood of the martyrs is seed. And every time one of these martyrs was put to death, people marveled at this. Because people are always interested when somebody has something worth dying for. When somebody does something altruistic or something that's unusual for human beings. They're always interested in that. And this was the great appeal of it. And it was said that many came to the faith every time a martyr was put to death. Tom, you look like you got your hand up.
The very fact that we know the end of these people,
right,
gives us the courage to be willing to stand too.
Absolutely. That's absolutely true. You know, you read Fox's Book of Martyrs, and I can only read a little of Fox's Book of Martyrs at one time, and it just makes me sick. It makes me almost physically sick to read about what our brothers and sisters had to deal with. I mean, well, let me just read you from Neander. Neander is a church historian who wrote a multi-volume, great big history of the church. I'll just read you one little bit here. This is from volume 1, page 148 of Neander, talking about this same time, the era of Diocletian. all assembling of the Christians for the purpose of religious worship was forbidden. This is during that eight-year period, 303 to 311 AD, the time when Galerius was doing what Diocletian had said. All assembling of the Christians for the purpose of religious worship was forbidden. The Christian churches were to be demolished to their foundations. All manuscripts of the Bible should be burned. Those who held places of honor and rank must either renounce their faith or be degraded in judicial proceedings. The torture might be used against all Christians of whatever rank. Those belonging to the lowest walks of private life were to be divested of their rights as citizens and freemen. Christian slaves were to be incapable of receiving their freedom as long as they remained Christians. This was all done to us. We can identify with these people. Basically, they believed what we believe, and they practiced what we practice. And it's a thing to think about. Would we be willing to stand? It is happening today in parts of the world, and always has been. Yes, Tom?
Refresh my mind as the timing for the death of Polycarp. What
155 A.D. February 23rd, 155 A.D.
So it was under Trajan's.
Yes, it was. Yes, that's right. Under Trajan's reign, or maybe between Trajan and Marcus Aurelius. Trajan was already gone, yeah. Now, when I give you these 10 waves, that doesn't mean these were the only waves. These were the big waves, but there were persecutions going on a regular basis, even in between the waves. Yes. So Polycarp was involved in this tenfold wave of general persecutions that we're talking about, yes. Was there anybody else? I think I might have squelched one or two there. I'm sorry. Okay. Well, let me read you, since we're on that subject and there seems to be an interest in it, I'll flip over to page 501 here in Gibbon at the risk of reading a little too much. This won't be a very long one. Same book, volume 1 of the Modern Library edition of Edward Gibbon. I have purposefully refrained from describing the particular sufferings and death of the Christian martyrs. It would have been an easy task from the history of Eusebius, from the declamations of Lactantius, and from the most ancient Acts to collect a long series of horrid and disgusting pictures and to fill many pages with racks and scourges, with iron hooks and red-hot beds, and with all the variety of tortures which fire and steel, savage beast, and the more savage executioners could inflict on the human body. The Roman Empire was a cruel empire, and they specialized in finding ways to invent worse and worse tortures to make us suffer and therefore make us recant. But God has built into the human body a mechanism whereby when your suffering gets to a certain place, you lapse into unconsciousness and are relieved. One time years ago, Oriana Falanchi interviewed the man who had been important in Greece, Alexander Paidagoulos. And he said that when he was in captivity and being tortured on a regular basis, he learned to appreciate unconsciousness. He said, I knew that it could only get so bad, and then I would lapse into unconsciousness for a while, and I would have this reprieve, and then I would come back, and they'd torture me some more. But I knew they couldn't torture me past a certain point. They were limited in what they could do, and that was a great relief for me, he said. Another man who was in a concentration camp during World War II by the name of Viktor Frankl and was persecuted by the Nazis. He was a Jewish psychiatrist. Viktor Frankl said that the Nazis chose everything I was going to do. They chose what time I would get up, where I would work that day, what I would eat, when I would sleep. They chose everything in my life except for one thing. They couldn't choose my attitude. I got to choose my attitude every morning. And he felt like he had some control of his life because of that. So we do find ways to cope, no matter how bad it gets. Here's a thing that I've learned from living several decades in this old world, and it took me a while to learn it, but it's been a comfort to me. So often when you have something that you're just dreading, as it turns out, the anticipation of that event may be a lot worse than the actual event itself. I've seen this true over and over again. I'll just dread something. And when it actually comes to pass, maybe it's bad, but it's not as bad as the dreading of it was. And I just wonder if the actual persecution might be that way. It's easy for us to sit in comfort and think, oh, if they were to come in, stormtroopers come in through that back door and line us up and try to make us recant the faith in the Lord and all. That would just be so terrible, I don't think I could stand it. But if we have steeled our minds ahead, if we comfort ourselves with the strength of God's Holy Spirit, the actual event might not even be as bad as the anticipation of it. We've been anticipating it for so long. For all these years, we've been telling each other, this may come, this may come. When it actually does come, if it does come, it might not take very long for them to even kill you. And the actual event might be a lot less bad than all the anticipation of it through the years. It is something you can withstand if you choose to. They cannot choose your attitude for you. They cannot force you to do something that you choose not to do. And if you stand for Jesus, then it will certainly be worthwhile.
Amen.
And I encourage every one of us to think through that, young or old. Think through it, because that time may well come. One of the reasons for studying this material is to realize they've been killing us for years. And as Mike Well points out, there are places on earth today where Christians are persecuted for their faith. There are an underground movement in those places today. Some places in China, this is going on right now. People who are attempting to restore the Lord's church and are paying a very heavy price to preach the gospel. And it could well and easily happen here. We just need to be aware of it and decide what our response is going to be. We can help each other in that, but primarily it comes down to standing alone. Be willing to stand alone. Yes?
To be thou faithful unto death.
Yes.
Unto death could be today.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
It certainly could. That was originally said in the context of one of the letters to the seven churches. We skipped chapters 2 and 3 because they've studied them here recently. But that was said in the instance of a suffering church in the New Testament here in chapter 2. Be thou faithful unto death, and I will give thee the crown of life. So that clarifies it. That makes it simple. And life really is that simple. Life doesn't have to be all complicated the way we make it. Very, very few things matter. Only one life will soon be passed. Only what's done for Christ will last. He confessed us, and he died for us, and we need to be willing to die for him. And I believe there are people in this room right now who are willing to die for him and would be willing to die for him tonight if it came to that. And I hope that you personally are one of those. Good questions, comments, and thoughts. Have we got anything else here on this fifth seal? Well, this persecution that I've been reading to you about, it started under Diocletian. Diocletian abandoned his imperial throne in 305. This persecution starts out in 303, and he abandons the throne in 305, goes and retires and takes up gardening. And somebody said to him, you know, why did you do that? And he took a couple of cabbages and he said, when I can raise cabbages like these, why would I want to be emperor? That's not a bad question, you know. Like Voltaire said in Candide, right at the end of it, he said, we must cultivate our garden. And you can do a lot worse than that. So Diocletian leaves the throne in 305, but Galerius, who had been his henchman, becomes more exalted in power and continues on for 8 years with this terrible persecution. Everybody who wanted to was invited to insult the disciples of Christ, beat them with cudgels and with rods and with straps and with ropes, take advantage of them. Some of us had our hands tied behind our backs and were hung, and our limbs were stretched by machines. The Christians were shamed, and they shamed their enemies also by their determination. Some were beheaded, some were burnt, many were killed. So many of them were killed in a single day that the executioners had to relieve each other because they were just worn out. And on one occasion, the axe that they were chopping people's heads off with became so blunted that it broke. It was just so dull from chopping off so many heads. They killed many, many Christians and tortured countless more, and yet new converts on all sides continued to proclaim themselves as Christians. And what are you going to do with people like that? What are you going to do with people like the Apostle Paul? Well, if you don't shut up about the gospel, we're just going to kill you, they said. And Paul said, fine, I have a desire to depart and be with Christ, which for me is far better. Well, if you feel that way about it, maybe we'll just let you live. Great, said Paul. And if you let me live, do I ever have a message for you? What are you going to do with people like that who don't fit into normal human categories of thinking? The authorities didn't know what to do with these people. The more we kill of them, the more of them there are. Diocletian declared the destruction of all Christian meeting houses. We have records of meeting houses that were burnt with the saints right in them. As if somebody would come to this meeting house, if it were made out of wood, it would be easier. But just pour gasoline all around the outside of it and burn it down with around our ears while we're sitting in here. And guard the exits so that we could not escape from the fire. This type of thing was done. Burning all the Christian books, death to assembled Christians. They were flogged till their flesh... I'm sorry. I just noticed the clock. Oh, why didn't somebody say something? That's the first time I've gone this far over. It's getting worse. Oh, it's just...
It's coming off of Kevin's next service.
I apologize. I had no idea. Anyway, you know, it's funny because just last night, Wayne said, well, if you're in the middle of a point, you can go 5 minutes over, but I'm almost 10 minutes over here. I apologize for that. And we'll conclude this evening by once again extending the Lord's invitation. We've been talking about these Christian martyrs and the things that they had to put up with. And it really is inspiring to think of what they faced. They make me want to be better. I find it very motivational to see what they put up with in those early centuries. These were, in many instances, really our brothers and sisters in Christ. So it's not an easy road, and you need to understand that coming in. You don't come to Christ if you're not willing to put Him first. But if you are willing to come to Him in simple trusting faith and put Him first, if you're willing to leave your baggage behind and make Him the priority of your life, there's no more fulfilling life than the Christian life. The Christian life helps you to know what to do with your life. It gives you a why to your life, the answer to the why of your life. We have people all around us in the world wandering around in hopeless ignorance. I don't say that pejoratively. It's just a fact. They seem to have no idea why they're here, no concept of what they need to do with their lives, and many of them are miserable because of that. But the Bible answers the question of where we came from, where we're going, and what we're supposed to be doing on the way there. If you want this purpose, if you want this saving Lord, if we can assist you in any way, or if you have anything else to bring before the assembled saints, please let us know what it is while we stand together. Ted's going to announce the number to sing.